This hour's top stories. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, says the U.S. must ensure Tehran that its unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal will not be repeated in the future. Protesters gather outside London's Downing Street, demanding leaders of the Group of Seven countries to stop selling arms to Israel. Also in the headlines, Germany calls for a pragmatic solution to a row over new trade agreements in Northern Ireland following Britain's warning to suspend the agreed protocol. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Iran says there are still a lot of technical, legal, and political discussions that need to be made before attempts to revive the nuclear deal can bear fruit. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, says Tehran is seeking assurances that the U.S. will not withdraw from the deal again. Here's a report by Homa Leski.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all US sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the U.S. will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the U.S. are not many, but they are of principal character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Political commentator Mr. Scott Bennett says there is no guarantee the U.S. administrations would remain committed to deals reached by their predecessors.
A presidential administration can change, moment by moment, day by day, any and all agreements and any and all treaties and such that are entered into. So there's really no firm reliance or absolute dependability on an American presidential administration and these promises. However, if I was advising the Iranians, I would say the best way to guarantee and ensure that the United States government and the presidential administration commits to and fulfills and honors all of the elements and promises of the JCPOA is to make it absolutely attractive and a deal that the American people themselves could not turn down. And that's really the target of all negotiation and diplomatic communications and public relations and persuasion operations should be towards the American people, not the government, not the military-industrial complex, not the Zionists in Congress or the Mossad-friendly puppets who have been extorted.
As the G7 summit reaches its climax in Cornwall, a day of rage and action for Palestine has been underway this Saturday to condemn world leaders for their lack of action in protecting Palestinians from Israeli aggression. Protests took place up and down the UK, but in London, thousands mobilized outside Downing Street demanding change. Robert Carter was on the scene.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
International lawyer John Philpott believes Western leaders who have committed crimes against Palestinian people have to be brought to justice.
People have to understand that if you sell arms that are going to be used to kill people in an occupation, because it's an occupation, right? Gaza is a concentration camp. They have the right to shoot at those who occupy them and keep them in prison. But if people, and the U.S. is selling apparently better arms because their arms, the arms that Israel had were not as accurate. So those who sell the arms are liable. If I sell a gun to my neighbor who goes and robs a bank, I am accomplice to that crime. And that applies to the U.S. leaders. It probably applies to Britain, and Canada sells arms to Israel, and Britain does. And it's not the ICC. I wouldn't want to emphasize the zeal of the ICC, but they are liable. The leaders who committed the crimes must be held liable, both criminally and civilly. In the, they must repair the damages. They must provide reparation.
European leaders deliver an ultimatum to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to keep his Brexit pledges to resolve a row over new trade arrangements in Northern Ireland. The European Commission President and the European Council Chief said both sides must implement what they agreed on, stressing that there is complete unity among EU members. German Chancellor Angela Merkel also called for a pragmatic solution to the thorny issue of post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland. Johnson has called for a compromise. He has threatened emergency measures if no solution is found over part of the post-Brexit deal that covers border issues with Northern Ireland. London and Brussels are at loggerheads over Northern Ireland protocol of the post-Brexit deal. Political commentator Keith Pilbeam says British Prime Minister Johnson is trying to fight the consequences of Brexit.
You know, Boris Johnson is finding out the consequences of Brexit and the deal that he signed. I mean, he only signed this deal just before Christmas. It's not even 5 months old, and he's trying to renege on it and disown it. Maybe he signed it and thought he could just disown it. But what he's learning is there's international law and you have to respect it. And you have to be trusted on the international stage. And so if you renege on this within 5 months and start invoking Article 16, you know, saying it's all a crisis and without that, then you're risking your reputation. And the point is, there was a choice to be made. There was either going to be a border in Ireland, which would have been terrible, or you have the border down the Sea, the Irish Sea, you know, between Britain and Northern Ireland. And that's what's happened. And there was only two possibilities once you leave the single market and the customs union. Had we stayed in the customs union, by the way, a lot of this would have been avoided. So these are the decisions that Boris Johnson took. They're the contract that he signed, and then he's trying to blame the EU for not playing good faith. Well, it's unbelievable. And it's coming home to roost now. He missold Brexit. He missold it to the British people. He missold it to the Northern Irish people. And now we're seeing the consequences. And, of course, if it was not for COVID, this would be front page. You know, every day, the consequences of Brexit. It's all hidden behind the COVID.
At least 18 people have been killed and several wounded in two separate artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. The first attack reportedly hit a residential area, with a second strike targeting a hospital shortly afterwards. A local Turkish official cited hospital sources as saying the Kurdish YPG militants hit the building with a missile. The official said Turkish artillery units shelled rural positions near the city of Ma'arat al-Nu'man in response. Turkey views the U.S.-backed YPG as a terrorist organization. In 2019, Turkey launched a cross-border operation in neighboring Syria under the pretext of pushing YPG-affiliated forces away from its borders. Thousands of Israelis have protested outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The protest comes on the eve of a crucial vote in parliament that could end the reign of the regime's longest-serving prime minister. Anti-Netanyahu protesters have staged rallies on an almost weekly basis since last July to denounce his handling of COVID-19 and the economy. Anti-Netanyahu sentiments have been deepened by his indictment while being in office. The premier is accused of accepting improper gifts and seeking to trade regulatory favors with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage. Israel's parliament will vote on the formation of a new cabinet on Sunday. If approved, Naftali Bennett would take over, leading an alliance of right-wing, left-wing, centrist, and Arab parties. Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian woman at a military checkpoint north of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli forces alleged that the woman had planned to carry out a stabbing attack at Qalandia checkpoint. Her brother said she died of her wounds after being left lying on the ground. Palestinian officials identified the victim as 27-year-old Ibtissam Kaabna. She had been detained and sentenced to 18 months in prison by Israel in 2016. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad movement condemned the killing as, quote, the ugliest form of terrorism. The Gaza-based resistance movement also criticized the international community's silence on Israel's atrocities. This comes a day after Israeli forces shot dead a 15-year-old Palestinian near the northern West Bank town of Nablus. New COVID-19 restrictions have been announced in the Russian capital of Moscow amid a rise in the number of coronavirus infections there. Mayor of Moscow has announced what he called a non-working week for all non-essential workers. Restrictions include the closure of food courts and playgrounds, while restaurants and cafes are ordered to close between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. The city has logged 6,700 new daily infections, the highest figure since December. Cases are also soaring in Russia's second largest city of St. Petersburg, which is co-hosting the Euro 2020 football championship. Leaders of the G7 have pledged to share 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines to give momentum to the global fight against the deadly disease. Activists, however, say more effort is needed to get the world back to normalcy. Campaigners have argued that this contribution is not enough to help the world get rid of the COVID-19 virus. It once again slammed powerful countries of vaccine hoarding, which has led to vaccine inequality.
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic, a slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
Human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The limelight.
Months into a debate at the World Trade Organization over suspending patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines in order to end the global pandemic, the delay has left Africa facing a third wave of deadly infections as countries across the continent confront dwindling supplies of vaccines. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Critics Decry Preventable Mass Death in Africa as Rich Nations Just Sit Back and Watch. Stay tuned for more. warmth into a debate at the World Trade Organization over suspending patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines in order to end the global pandemic. The delay has left Africa facing a third wave of deadly infections as countries across the continent confront dwindling supplies of vaccines. As The Guardian reported recently, eight countries have seen cases rise by more than 30% in the last week, and officials have raised alarm over possible looming shortages of hospital beds and oxygen unless the outbreaks can be brought under control. In this wave, the intensity of severe and critically ill COVID-19 patients and deaths is higher than what we experienced in the first wave of the pandemic, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said recently. The country has recorded nearly 53,000 COVID-19 cases and 383 deaths. But officials say that fatalities in Uganda and across Africa have likely been vastly undercounted due to low COVID-19 testing numbers. The continent has seen nearly 5 million coronavirus cases and has reported more than 130,000 deaths, nearly 4% of worldwide deaths from the virus. Uganda is expecting 3 million vaccine doses from COVAX, the UN-backed facility tasked with getting doses to developing countries, but has received only 1 million so far as it recorded a 131% weekly increase in COVID-19 infections last week. Fewer than 2% of people in sub-Saharan Africa have received vaccine doses, and while wealthy countries like the U.S. have started vaccinating children as young as 12 to prevent the spread of COVID-19 to vulnerable populations, many African countries are struggling to get second doses of the vaccines to high-risk groups, leaving them only partially inoculated. Four African countries, including Eritrea, Tanzania, Burundi, and Chad, have yet to begin administering any vaccinations. The threat of a third wave in Africa is real and rising. Dr. Matashidiso Moeti, Regional Director for Africa at World Health Organization, WHO, told The Guardian, "Our priority is clear. It's crucial that we swiftly get vaccines into the arms of Africans at high risk of falling seriously ill and dying of COVID-19," he added. The wave of the pandemic is spreading across the continent as progressive organizations and public health experts double down on demands that WTO suspend patents for COVID-19 treatments and vaccines, a possibility the organization has been weighing for months. As Common Dreams reported recently, consumer advocacy group Public Citizen slammed the European Union's intention to block negotiations that the rest of the world supports to temporarily waive intellectual property barriers to end the pandemic and save lives at TRIPS Council meeting that is held recently. Dozens of countries have come out in support of a waiver since the Biden administration announced it backed temporarily lifting patent protections in early May, but the EU, Germany, and the UK are continuing to block the measure. The EU has so far refused to engage in productive discussions on the proposal and continues to instead rally for voluntary measures by pharmaceutical corporations, which so far have shown limited success, said Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, Doctors Without Borders, recently with the group's international medical secretary, Dr. Maria Guevara, calling on world governments to do everything in their power to make sure that every country has the best chance to save as many lives as possible throughout this pandemic. Amid repeated calls for global cooperation to stop the pandemic in its tracks, said Global Justice Now, Nick Dearson, the international response to the third wave in Africa amounts to preventable mass death that rich governments just sit back and watch. More than 100 countries, over 400 lawmakers, and 175 Nobel laureates have joined public health experts at the WHO and other global organizations to call for patent waivers. More than 60 countries have expressed support for a revised waiver proposal by South African and Indian officials, which is being debated at the two-day meeting that is going to be held very soon. Europe must stop standing in the way of fair vaccine distribution, said Oxfam EU recently, adding, people in low-income countries can't be left waiting for half a century for their vaccine.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, I'm your host Mudaffar Haider. Here in the studio today we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So, we've just witnessed a war in which the Palestinian resistance actually overcame and defeated and vanquished the Zionists, Israel, the cancerous entity of Israel, rather. Now, the question I'd like to ask is, there have, and this is something that you raised in the previous episode as well, that there have been conflicts going on for the last 70 plus years. So what makes this particular conflict different? I mean, really, what was the difference? We saw missiles coming from one side to the other and missiles going back. Is this not what we have seen throughout the history of what they refer to as the Palestine-Israel conflict? We're going to Sheikh Ali.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we have to, and I know I use this word myself, conflict. Conflict is between two legitimate parties, right? Those who have something to give and take.
Ooh,
and lose.
You just.
The Zionist regime never was a legitimate entity. It doesn't have a right to be in any conflict, let alone be at conflict with Palestine. So that's something, you know, as a side note. But unfortunately, for the lack of better word, we'll just say, you know, the war, the conflict, the fight. When we look at the Zionist regime, right, throughout the history, and I know we don't have time to go into all of it, right? Mm. If you start from the inception of the Zionist regime since 1948, you know how Arabs fought against the Zionist regime,
yep,
and they were defeated. You know, that whole Arabism, right, pan-Arabism, some called it. They were defeated, right? It kept going and going up until we hit the early 2000s when the war against Gaza was waged. And it's, I think, the first time really, like, when the world saw that Palestinians were victorious. So from 1948 up until 2008.
Wow.
Right? This is the first time when the world saw and felt and realized that, okay, no, the resistance in Palestine, you know, it's bearing fruits. Up until that time, everybody was like, resistance is just, you know, a waste of time, energies, resources.
My God, you're right, because, and success drives.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that the resistance is going to continuously get stronger.
Right.
There may have been some people inside Palestine and outside as well who thought, well, this resistance is bearing no fruits. We're
exactly
having no successes.
Exactly.
Why are we fighting?
And
no
that
point.
Included friends and hypocrites,
mm-hmm,
right? Hypocrites who just didn't want to fight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were there too. But even friends, they came to that conclusion, except for the core of the Islamic resistance, which was the Islamic leadership, since after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Imam Khomeini and Rahbar, they never changed their stance.
Yeah,
Imam Khomeini for the entire of his life.
I was actually just looking through a book of Imam Khomeini's on Palestine, and his opinions are exactly what Rahbar is saying today. I mean, it's the same.
And they never
thing.
Changed in the middle. You know, it's not like Imam Khomeini started something, and then since we saw so many defeats, and you know, the morale come down, and Rahbar he goes around and changes his stance, and then. You know,
it's
after 2008, it picks up again. It was not like that.
No, it's always been unity, resistance.
Yes.
Unity and resistance. That's
for Islamic leadership, that's what it was, right? Mm. For general masses out there, for analysts, for, you know, they started to believe in resistance after 2008, which is actually, in fact, 13 years ago, right? Now, this recent onslaught on Palestine, it resulted in a very shameless defeat for the Zionist regime. Again, Zionist regime that was so used to of winning, being on the victorious side since 1948. Everything they wanted, they did it. Right? From occupying to, you know, demolishing the homes and from exiling people to, you know, raping women, you know, killing children, bombing hospitals, unchecked, right? Through the support of the United States of America and Britain and their cohorts. Now, in 2006, with the Hezbollah war, 2008, with the Gaza war, the Zionist regime, first time ever, had to face a public humiliation where they were defeated at the hands of not governments, not countries, just resistance groups through guerrilla fights and through very, you know. Now, they realized that, okay, they're not as strong as they were thinking they were. After 2008, they have been regrouping, re-energizing, re-strategizing, because they remember 2006 and 2008, right? Those two wars where they were defeated. So they're like, okay, we are really going to flatten Palestine this time around, yeah? So they've been planning.
Right.
They've been, you know, getting all their equipment up to date, you know, and trainings and this and that and plans. And they launched this war after all this planning.
Yeah, when you say it like that, that is such an eye-opener. I mean, it's so true. They were defeated by Hezbollah 2006. This time when they were attempting to attack Palestine, I mean, it must have been like, okay, we are going to go in and completely brutalize and destroy it. We're going to punish them, in fact.
Exactly. And 2008, they were defeated by these same Palestinians, right?
Mm.
So after that, this is that major war that broke out, again initiated by the Zionist regime. This means they were prepared with their Iron Dome, with their cutting-edge technology, with all that pride and, you know, tons of trillions of dollars pumped into their military arsenal and equipment, right? What happens? In 12 days, they're on their knees wanting to do a truce. This is what the world just
You know, it's
this
really...
This is how this war is different.
Really, really fascinating, because so many people have kind of lost faith in Israel. So many of those Zionists, they're actually just leaving the occupied territories now. They're going back to their homes in America and Europe, back to where they came from.
Oh, yeah. I saw a report by RT.
Israel's really... And the politicians of Israel, they're really trying to save face. So they came up with this superhero called Iron Dome. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so laughable. It was so funny. They're trying to restore this. You know, no, we're strong, guys. We're strong. And the world is just laughing at them. So they posted it on Twitter, and Twitter, everybody on Twitter just jumped on the bandwagon,
just attacking
and mocking
them. One more point before you go
to
say it.
Yep.
This Iron Dome, too, you know, it's being said that 10% of the missiles, it couldn't stop, but 90% of it did. This is a flat-out lie. This is being said by those who are on Israel's side.
Mm-hmm.
The mouthpieces of Israel are saying that 10% came in, 90% were obstructed by the Iron Dome. This is a flat-out lie. I just want everybody to know out there. At least, I believe, you know, very, if you look at it as a third person, not as a, you know, party, at least 50% of them got across and they did the damage.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is ArsToday.com.
You can email us at EnglishRadio@IRIB.ir.
Yeah, just on that note as well, the types of missiles that were provided, the Badr 5 missiles to Palestine, were a special type of missile, which actually were designed to explode in the sky. And so it was the shrapnel that would come down that would actually destroy infrastructure and hurt the Zionists. And so even the Iron Dome, if it was able to intercept, it still didn't have its effect of preventing casualties because they were designed to explode in the sky anyway. So, yeah, very good point. Syed, how did this make you feel? I mean, all of this is going on. We're talking about it in such an excited way. I can see you in the corner of my eye kind of smiling gleefully. I mean, I'm curious to find out how you feel or how it made you feel.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's interesting that there were three words that come to my mind when it comes to how this war, this 12-day war, you know, at least made me feel as I was following it for these 12-plus days. The first one, I'll say the three, and then I'll talk a little bit about them. The first one is anger. The second one is disappointment, and the third one is hope. So as far as anger, the anger, of course, stems from the witnessing holy sanctuaries being defiled. Anger stems from these innocent children dying. Anger stemming from innocent women dying. Peaceful protesters being attacked for no reason other than them being together and wanting to defend themselves and their lives and their property. You know, anger at children, young children. The one that's very famous is the 3 or 4 or 5-year-old child who was being pulled out from under the rubble of buildings destroyed by Zionist airstrikes. The second here is disappointment. Disappointment at the fact that global leaders and leaders all across the world were silent. They have been silent in the face of 70-plus years of Zionist crimes against humanity and against the Palestinians. They have been deathly silent, never condemning Israel. And matter of fact, in this current 12-day war, we saw that many countries tried to bring forth, you know, a proposal to condemn Israeli war crimes, to condemn the Zionist war, to stop the war. But interestingly, it was the United States of America that prevented any kind of proposal from even coming up to be discussed.
And so sometimes it's worse. They don't not condemn Israel.
Right.
They condemn it weekly. And that's even worse because that makes some of the public go.
But I just like the most, I was going to say hate. Let me just say it. It's that balance policy.
The both
parties, you know, they have something good about them and something bad about them. They both have some sort of a right. And no, this is not supposed to be. And this seems, you know, especially for those who claim or consider themselves to be academic, you know, they're the ones who push this whole, you know,
the BBC
thing, you know.
Is the master at doing that. This impartiality. No, we're not being biased. Both sides are attacking. Man,
just by saying
up.
That you're being biased.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? An occupier versus an occupied, and you're saying both sides are at fault. Yeah. This is being biased.
Imagine like if there was a huge, huge, bulky kid in a class, right, and he goes up to some little pipsqueak girl, starts punching her in the face, and the teacher says, and the girl starts crying and shouting back, and then the teacher says, no, you're both at fault. You shouldn't have shouted back. I mean, that's what these people are doing. It's ridiculous.
It really is, and it causes a lot of shame. It causes a lot of disappointment to the people watching these things on television and to the people knowing, you know, that there is silence at such a great level. And like you said, not just silence, but weekly condemn. Or not just weekly condemn. In this case, where the United States stopped a proposal from coming forth, they didn't even let others speak about it. So it's interesting, is not only do they themselves remain silent on the issue, they also make others remain silent on the issue. It's really very disappointing. And what was even worse in this last part about disappointment is the fact that the United States was sending aid to the Zionist regime while this 12-day war was going on. You know, how can people expect the United States of America to be an honest broker in this, you know, Palestinian issue when this is the way they act?
I don't think they even pretend to be a broker anymore. Back in the day, yeah, they would say, like, you know, we send this much aid to Palestinian authorities, which, again, are their puppets, and they try to play out this broker role. But I don't think they're even pretending this anymore, right? Especially after the deal of the century, right? It was very clear how they have a full-on plan to just completely wipe Palestine and Palestinians and deprive them of their rights. Mm. If they have to live in their own lands and that region, they have to live there as a second-class or maybe third-class or maybe fourth-class citizen. They don't have no rights, right? They can't travel. Mm. They're not going to have... And we talked about deal of the century before here, too. It's just the three of us, right? They don't have right to defend themselves. They don't have right to, you know, arm themselves. All of the diplomatic relationships are going to be in the hands of Israel and so on and so forth. And this is United States of America playing the ball here.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
They are not a broker anymore. Mm-hmm. That phase is gone. That ended like 10 years ago or something.
Sid, Matthew, the clock is ticking.
Yeah, the last word here, because I want to do it so we don't have to go to another episode, is hope. So we had anger, we had disappointment, and the last word is hope. Hope in the Palestinian people, especially how we saw that they put up such a beautiful fight, a beautiful resistance, and the balance of power, as Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei says, has swung in the favor of Islam. Hope in people of the region that they are becoming awake and they are moving forwards towards this common goal of humanity, which is the freedom of Palestine. And finally, hope in people that are all across the world who we have seen have stood up in solidarity with Palestine more so than ever before.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show, from myself and from our dear, beloved, fantastic guests. We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taken my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Recently, a group of child rights experts have strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding 8 parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Alan Rock, who was Canada's ambassador to the UN from 2003 to 2006 and served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, titled UN Should Stop Playing Politics with Children's Lives. The article was published by the Al Jazeera website. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Children around the world suffer the consequences of war. They're routinely killed, maimed, recruited to fight, and otherwise abused. In 2020, the United Nations reported more than 25,000 such grave violations in the previous year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has powerful tools at his disposal to pressure those responsible to end such abuses, but he is failing to use them, often placing politics above children's lives. Over the past 20 years, the UN Security Council has put in place a framework to protect children in conflict zones. It requires the Secretary General to report every year on grave violations against children, including killing and maiming, recruiting child soldiers, sexual violence, and bombing schools. The Secretary General is required to attach a list of those responsible to his report. The list of shame, as it is sometimes called, is the linchpin for holding parties accountable for grave violations. When used as intended, the list has been a remarkably effective tool. Governments and non-state armed actors alike dread the stigma of being listed and are motivated to engage with the UN on steps they can take to end their abuses and be removed from the list. Rock wrote, "I have seen for myself the power of the list. In 2006, I served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, where I met with dozens of heartbroken families whose children had been abducted by the Tamil Tigers or the government-linked Tamil Makal Pulkal, that is TMVP, and forced to fight in Sri Lanka's civil war. The TMVP was added to the list of shame in 2006. Following intensive dialogue with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, it signed and implemented an action plan to end the abductions, and it was removed from the list in 2011. Rock said, "At that time, there was a palpable sense of optimism among those of us working to protect children in armed conflicts. We saw the Secretary General's list as a strong instrument to root out practices like recruiting child soldiers. And for many years it was. In addition to the TMVP in Sri Lanka, the list shamed many others into changing their ways. Among them, the Maoists in Nepal, government forces in Chad, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. However, in recent years, decisions about listing have become increasingly politicized, undermining the list's potential to protect children. For example, in 2016, the UN's then Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, removed the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from his list. Even though coalition airstrikes massacred more than 450 children and injured hundreds the previous year. The reason? Saudi threats to withdraw UN funding. Although Secretary General Guterres returned the Saudi coalition to his list in 2017, he removed it again in 2020, despite the UN's own findings that the coalition was responsible for at least 222 child casualties the previous year. Guterres has also removed the Myanmar Armed Forces, the Tatmadaw, from the least for recruiting and using children, despite hundreds of documented violations in 2019 and 2020. Alan Rock noted, "These betrayals prompted me to join a group of international children's rights experts to conduct a systematic review of the Secretary General's listing and delisting decisions over the past decade and to make recommendations to end the politicization of this process." The author of this article said, "The extent of the discrepancies we found was shocking. There is a clear mismatch between information about violations documented by the UN itself and the groups and government forces on the list. Our review identified dozens of cases in which multiple violations did not lead to listing or in which listing decisions reflected unexplained inconsistencies." Rock continued, "Our analysis also found that government forces have often had a free pass for committing violations. Of 8 parties responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children in a 1-year period that were not listed, 6 were governments, including state armed forces or occupation forces in Afghanistan, the DRC, the Israeli regime, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia. Israeli troops, terrorists, and occupation forces in Afghanistan have each been responsible for thousands of child injuries and deaths since 2014, but have never been listed." Alan Rock concluded, "Protecting children among the most vulnerable in war should be a politics-free zone. Their interests should be paramount when calling out abuses. Secretary General Guterres needs to address the issues we have identified and produce a credible, accurate, and evidence-based list in his upcoming annual report. Treating parties to conflict based on their conduct, not their political influence, is the only way to restore the list as a powerful tool in responding to grave violations against children in war." Recently, a group of child rights experts has strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding 8 parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. In a report, experts from Watch List on Children, an international child rights group, said at least 8 parties to conflicts were found responsible for killing and maiming more than 100 children in a single year, but were excluded from the blacklist. The report said there were numerous discrepancies and omissions in listing decisions, as well as unwarranted delisting decisions, noting that the UN Security Council's 2001 resolution establishing the list to protect children from the horrors of war is being seriously undermined and could result in putting children at even greater risk. The report said the Secretary General's 2015 annual report acknowledges that the number of children killed by the Israeli regime in 2014 was the 3rd highest in the world, and the number of schools damaged or destroyed was the highest anywhere in the world that year. And yet, the Israeli regime has not been listed in the report's annexes. It added that at the time, the news media reported that the Zionist regime and the United States conducted intense lobbying to prevent the regime's blacklisting. The child rights experts also cited annual reports that have repeatedly found the Israeli regime forces responsible for high levels of Palestinian child casualties, including over 1,525 killed and maimed in 2020 alone. They added, "Yet, Israeli regime forces have yet to be included in the annexed list of violations." According to the AP, co-author Yangi Li, former chair of the committee that monitors implementation of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, said, We are calling on the Secretary General to urgently address these problems and commit to hold all countries and groups responsible for violations against children accountable without fear or favor. In response to the report, UN spokesman Stefani Dojarik said Secretary General Antonio Guterres stands by the report's conclusions, expressing willingness to engage with relevant partners in how to improve the system. Benyam Dwight Mizmore, another co-author of the report, urged the UN to ensure that the list of perpetrators it issues is more credible, accurate, complete, and evidence-based, or risk pulling apart this unique tool for the protection of children caught in war. The report also said the Saudi-led war coalition against Yemen was delisted in 2020 for killing and maiming children in the Arab country, despite being responsible for a documented 222 child casualties during the reporting period. It noted, with this delisting, the Saudi-led coalition has been removed from the Secretary General's list altogether. Citing the Secretary General's reports that said the Saudi-led coalition was delisted due to a sustained significant decrease in the number of violations they committed, the rights experts said such argument runs counter to the established delisting criteria. They maintained this runs counter to the delisting criteria established in 2010 and the Security Council's stated expectations that delisting is based on whether or not grave violations against children took place in violation of international obligations. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, the Saudi war on Yemen has killed 250,000 people, including women and children, since it was launched in March 2015 with the aim of restoring the Riyadh-friendly government of former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.